Okay, Boker Tov. Good morning, everybody. It's a bit early in the day to talk about Purim because we've got a leap year. So I'm dedicating this year in honor of my daughter's birthday because although she is hitting her 41st birthday, in leap years, because she was born in Adar Aleph, she's now the grand age of 14. So she should always be young at heart, and please God, my daughter Lisheva, my 40-year-old daughter, so 41-year-old. And we always joke about that. So this is the sort of intro to Purim. I sort of immediately throw in a bit of a warning about the shir because comes from the reaction of my students. Last semester I taught this course. There are in fact 16 shirim online if you want to follow this up. On Megillat Esther and Wayu Torah. This is just a bit of an intro into those 16 shirim. But if you get a chance to listen to them, this is where it's all coming from. And one of the students that I taught this to gave me the ultimate compliment. I've mentioned this to a number of people. And the compliment was a young lady who's been through the what I call the best of the yeshiva day schools in the tri-state area. And after the course, last lesson of the course, she put up her hand and said, "Rabbi, why did our teachers in high school never teach us this?" And I thought, that's great. That's the ultimate compliment because how do you teach Megillat Esther to people who know Megillat Esther? How do you get a new view of a story that you all know? Not only you all know it, but you've all grown up with it, right? And you still deal with it, you know, depending on the ages of your children and now of our grandchildren, in terms of dressing up and what it be, you know, the whole Purim thing. And when we're dealing with the actual event, well, almost, I think, the only way I can describe it is we are keen to, you know, as the story is covered over a little bit, so the in terms of the way that we understand, we dress up, we cover ourselves over, the whole story seems to be covered over. And we need to sort of open the lid, historic lid on the whole thing. And once we do that, I feel two things happen. Number one, the story becomes much more real. And number two, some things in the Megillah, a lot of things I can't go into now, just begin to make sense. I'll give you one question which I'm going to raise at the beginning, from the Megillah itself. Go through a bit of what we're going to say from the historical perspective, and then come back to the Megillah and show you how now it begins to make sense. And the question is simple. Beginning of chapter 1, we're told about Ahasuerus, who we'll find out who he is for real, right? A lot of our misconceptions start with the way that we look upon this gentleman, you know, as a bit of a buffoon. People dress up as Ahasuerus, and it's always a bit of a clown. Not really the way he was, I assure you, not quite the way he was. We have, in the first chapter of the Megillah, two parties. Right? I don't know if it's clear to us, but this is what it actually says. I'll just read the word. I didn't want to give out the books, but just to explain. Bishnat Shalosh al-Molcho, he was king for 3 years, and he makes a party, L'chol Sarav Avadav, he makes a party for the people, the chel. Chel is the army. He's inviting the army, the generals, partumim, sarei amedinot, and the princes of all the countries to come to the party. And what is he doing at the party? Baharoto, he's showing off osher, kavod malchuto, right? We all know these psukkims, we sing them every year. All of the riches that he has, etc., etc., and it lasts for 180 days. Okay, that's a pretty severe party. And then, it says at the end of those 180 days, a second party for 7 days. Now, as my mother would have said, genug showing. You know, you had 180 days, would you need another 7 days, excuse me, to go and get, you know, sort of plastered for another 7 days? It just is strange. And we've always taken this for granted. This is what happened. And the second party, it says, is for the people in Shushan, specifically not mentioning the officers and the partimim, all these words that we can't translate. And it goes through a little bit of the detail of that party. We know that was the party when Vashti met her rather sad end and all the rest of it. And what's going on? Two parties. Why? Why did he have to make two separate gatherings? Right? It's a simple question, and I know that there are pshetlich on pshetlich going back in history for who knows how long, trying to explain maybe some of this, but I want to give you a take on this, which really is revolutionary, as far as I'm concerned. I hope it will be for you. I just want to give a bit of Hakara Satov, the This goes back to a visit to Israel about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I decided, this is Chatoi Animaska Ayom, please don't take a psakalocha from this, that being in Israel, I would decided on Yom Tov over Sukkot, I would do as the Romans do, as the Israelis do, and we ended up second day Yom Tov being Chol HaMoed. As far as I was concerned, that was it, keeping one day Chag. And of course, where do you go for Chol HaMoed if you've got nothing else to do? You end up in a mall. I should have stayed in shul, I know, that was pretty what I should have done. But to say to the credit... That's why we ended up in the mall. But to the credit of the mall, they had a bookstore there, which I really found something, a gem. So I've got to say, you know, in the end of the day, it was worth it. There's a rabbi in Israel I've spoken about before. Many of you have heard the name, somebody called Binyamin Lau. Benny Lau comes to America occasionally. He is probably today one of the sort of most prolific scholars in Israel in terms of writing, in terms of presentation. He's on the radio very often, and his shul... He's actually just resigned from his shul because he's going to retire. I think he's in his 60 already, which is incredible. He looks like he's 4 years old, but he's really sort of got to that stage. And one of the books that he brought out, which looks like the kid's Megillah, right? You know, you have a book like this with a picture of a clown on the front. And I was going to ignore the book. Turns out that it's his commentary on the Megillah, which is unbelievable. And the reason why it's unbelievable, because he says something which I've been feeling for years. He says, you go through Purim, it's an evolution. What I mean by that, I'm talking next time about evolution, so I'm just throwing that in. What's the evolution of Purim? First, he said, when you're young, it's about dressing up, and it's about the fun, and in Israel, Ad Leyoda, they have all the carnivals, carnivalim, as they call them in Hebrew, wonderful word. And the reality is that that's the beginning. Then you get to yeshiva. What happens in yeshiva, good morning, Boker Tov. What happens in yeshiva is that you then get the emphasis on Adela Yoda, you know, and you learn all the songs, how to sing while you're drunk and all that sort of stuff. Don't want to be reminded of all that. And eventually what happens is Ben Ilai himself became Rav Kibbutz. He was Rav in Kibbutz Lavi for a number of years. And he said the kibbutz had a whole style of presentation of celebration of Purim, which was very unique in the kibbutz, Erev Neshev, I don't know what they call it, I don't know how you translate that. And he said he got to a certain point and Purim just didn't speak to him anymore. Right? You know, he was wondering, what is this really what it's meant to be all about? This is a serious chag, it's a rabbinic festival which was established by the rabbis a long time ago. And what's the essence of the holiday? And he says that's when he started doing his PhD in Bar-Ilan. And he said the whole world opened up to him about Purim, because he said he studied the ancient period, classical history, and all of a sudden, things began to make sense about the holiday that he'd never understood before. So we'll go with a bit of what he says, and we'll take it as follows. And if you look at the first handout that I gave you, the one with the timeline, what happens with Purim? The question that all the scholars, both rabbinic and I would say secular people who try to deal with this, is to say, when did the story take place? It's almost timeless. It's not really given a year, right? We can sort of pitch the Hanukkah story, 165 BCE, that's the normal date that we give it. Purim, we're not sure. We don't put dates on it, right? It's one of those things that we don't do. And Rav Lau says, you know what, it's a challenge. When did Purim actually take place? So if you look at the page that I gave you, the first handout with a lot of Hebrew writing on it, I'm not going to go through all the psukim, but what I want to show you is the timeline in the middle, because this is very significant. Very much the tradition about Purim is that it's a festival of the diaspora. Right, that's what we understand. It's happened in the diaspora. It was Jews. God is hidden in the story. It's not even mentioned. The word Melech is considered a hint to God, but not direct mention of Hashem. And it's a diaspora story. And the link to Eretz Israel is tenuous. Let's put it that way. You learn the Gemara, Megillah. It becomes a bit clearer what the link is. But even there, it's not a holiday which we celebrate, you know, as something total, like Hanukkah, which is totally revolving around Israel. Purim isn't, at least until today. Maybe there's something here which is interesting to find out. If you look at the page in front of you, you'll see that the dates, I put them in BCEs because I think that just makes more sense to us than doing the Hebrew dates. You've got the beginning of exiles, right? We know that the date that everyone, I think, will recognize, 586, which is the second date on the page, is when the first temple was destroyed. Before that, there were periods of exile when Jewish kings were exiled. right? There's go back. In fact, I've got didn't put it on the page, but I've written it on the other side, on the right hand side. There was the death of Josiah. Josiah was the last Jewish king who basically tried to salvage the disaster that was going on in Eretz Israel. And he tried to bring people back to Yiddishkeit, they tried to make a Korban Pesach. There's a whole story about him. And 32, 33 years old, he goes into battle against the Egyptians and he's killed. Dies, and that's really the end of it. And Rav Lau wants to suggest that from the death of Josiah, death of Yoshiyon, that represents essentially the beginning of the 70 years. We know there's going to be a 70-year exile. And he says, you know what, it's not clear whether the 70 years begins with the actual destruction of the temple, or in fact the 70 years begins with the process of exile. And the process of exile begins essentially with the death of Josiah. Because once Yoshiyahu dies, in very quick time after that, the Jews the beginning of the movement of the Jewish people out of Israel. You've got Golus Yehoyachin, Golos Yehoyachim, and all the different names that are used over there, and I'm not going to go through all the names because it's all very, very confusing. Always have been to me, but basically I tried to put some of it on the page. And you've got essentially a period running from the year, and I didn't put it on here, but I should have added it, 609, down to the year 586, which is basically the beginning and the completion of destruction of the temple and the exile process which had begun before the temple was destroyed. I just want to state that as a kind of intro. And then you jump to the year, you'll see the third date is 539. Now if you think about it, if you start the exile process 609 BCE and you go back 70 years, remember the numbers go down, you get to the year 539. So what we are looking at in the year 539, interestingly, is the emergence of the Persian Empire, right? The Babylonians lasted for some period of time, Nebuchadnezzar, etc., etc. And 539, along comes Cyrus, Koresh, famous, mentioned in the book of Daniel and various other places, and he makes a pronouncement. And his pronouncement is phenomenal. The peoples that were conquered by the Babylonians, be it the Jewish people and presumably lots of other nations that they conquered and they brought to Babylon, and we know they were very successful in Babylon. We know the book of Daniel, look what Daniel achieved. He became sort of second in charge of almost of the country. He was so high up in the hierarchy of the Babylonian, got close to Nebuchadnezzar. Read the book of Daniel, it's a whole revelation over there, which is interesting in itself. So you've got in 539 Cyrus, who now the Babylonian Empire was taken over by the Persians. Cyrus is coming along and saying to the Jewish people, along with everybody else, go home, go back to Eretz Israel, go back and rebuild your temple. He's giving them permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Very interesting. And you see the whole thing is also brought in Sefer Ezra. It's a fascinating thing. And Rav Lau points out, which is so interesting, I've got a big gap in the timeline, because you go to the right-hand side, you've got 538. Right? This is not to scale. And what happens, you'll see the paragraph underneath, the Jews do not listen to the proclamation of Cyrus. A small number of Jews go back to Eretz Israel in that year between 539 and 538, but the majority of Jews stay, maybe understandably, in their comfortable existence in Babylon. Amazing how they managed to adapt in such a short period of time, but this is what we're good at doing, we know that. And we've got the famous reference to that Aliyah from the Haftarah, Roni Vasimchi. We read the Haftarah of Hanukkah. Yeah, we know the story there. And the paragraph I want to read with you is the top of the page on the right-hand side from the Kuzari. The Kuzari of Yehuda Alevi. He talks about this period in Jewish history. And he says there really was, I suppose you would call it a missed opportunity. A major missed opportunity. Look at this comment that the Kuzari makes about the Jews being allowed to go back to Eretz Israel in 539, 538, and not taking up the opportunity. In fact, we read they began the project of building the temple, the second temple, and it stopped. And it stopped for a long period of time because of interruptions from within the society, from outsiders. It's a complicated issue, and the whole thing went cold. It really went cold for a long period of time. Says the Kuzari, and I want to read this. It's a short paragraph, it just goes over the page. He says, Havon Azeh, this sin, Hu Hashem mananu mi'ashlamat ma sheyodanu, sorry, ma sheyodnu bo, hu Elohim b'bayit sheni. What we did, not taking up the challenge of rebuilding the temple, is something which was a serious sin. K'mo she'ne'emar, because if we read, Roni v'simchi bat Zion, famous psukim, rejoice, O daughter of Zion, ki kavar haya hinyan Elokim mezuman, that at that point, as it were, it was already available, lachul, to happen, meaning the return to Eretz Yisrael, kasher b'techila, ilu hayu maskimim, kulam lashu. It needed a lot of people to go back. B'nefesh chafetza, with a strong will. Aval shavu miktzatam. Kuzari says, only a few went back. V'nisharu rubam, v'gidulehem, or gedolehem, that's an interesting word. He says the gedolim, right? A word that they use today a lot. Gedolei Yisrael. The great people of that community stayed. B'bavel, in Babylon. Rotzim begalut. He's pretty direct what he's saying here. They wanted to stay there in the exile. Ubavoda shelo yipardu mimishkanot. It's pretty shocking here. He didn't want to leave their homes in the five towns, in Tinek, and you name it, wherever. This was all, the echo of Rav Lau, he says it stronger than I do, so I'm not going to repeat what he says, but he says the echoes of our existence are really very interesting from this paragraph. If you just turn over the page, I'll just finish what he says. They had a lot of business interests in the Gola, which we know that's the situation as it is today. Maybe this is what Shlomo was saying. I am asleep. Libi arba, my heart is wakening from Shia Shin. What does that mean? Kinaha galut b'sheina, like we're asleep in the exile. V'halev ha'er hatmadat. It's difficult to read. Hanavua b'neim. This the heart is trying to awaken this prophecy of return. Kol dodi dofek, famous psukim. The knocking of my beloved. My beloved is knocking at the door. Kriyat Elohim Lashuv, God is calling us to go back. Sheroshi Nimlatal, we know that pasuk. Also, my head is filled with dew. What does that mean? Ala Shechina Sheyatsa Mitzlalei HaMikdash, that the divine presence which left the temple is beginning to return. Umar Sheomar Pashatit Tontai Al Atzlutam Lashuv, and in the end, when the chance came through Cyrus, which is what he's referring to, he says they were lazy. Dodi shalach yodo min achord, my beloved sent out his hand. Al Ezra shaya potser bahem, Ezra begged them to go back. Unechemia v'anaviyim, ad shahodu miktzatam, some of them did agree in the end, 40,000 Jews did go back. Lashuv hoda'a, Bilti Gemura, to give praise, and incomplete. We know that the second temple just, you know, wasn't the same as the first, and in the end it didn't survive. This is the Kuzari. So basically, what is going on is that you've got, the significant date is 538, 539, when Cyrus allows the Jews to go back, and they don't. And you can see what the Kuzari writes about that. If you turn over, you've got, and I'm looking now at the numbers. I must have another version of this because I think I printed my old version. Because you've got that section in the middle, which is 65 years. From 538, you go back 65 years, meaning you get to the year 533, 473. That is the date of the Aliyah of Ezra. So there's one number which is missing here. Over the Aliyah of Ezra is the year 473 BCE. If you've got from 538 to 473, there's a period of 65 years. Rav Lau argues that is a period when Am Yisrael, the Jewish people in Persia, kind of represent the whole of the Gola at that time, and they did not take up the challenge. They were comfortable. So much so, remember that when the party in Persia, which we're going to talk about at the end, comes about, they go there. They don't have any qualms about going, and it's not kosher. And, you know, you think about what happened in Cincinnati, what was it, 1885, on Yom Kippur, the Reform movement made the big celebration with trafers, right, wasn't it? It was a trafer on Yom Kippur. I mean, it just, the echoes of this are just scary. And you've got a period of 65 years. Rav Lau says that is the time period of Megillat Esther. And why is that so interesting and significant? He says as follows. And this is where it gets fascinating. He says, let's look at, and this is the second page, which again, you can take away, you can read all this, is from Wikipedia. And you'll see at the bottom, right, you've got essentially from 538 Cyrus till Xerxes, 486, you've got Darius in the middle. Well, I'm not going to go into all of that, but you've got essentially Xerxes, and as he points at the top on this article, Xerxes, who we know as Ahasuerus. So immediately, if we're calling Ahasuerus Xerxes, we've got a different character to deal with than the buffoon, the idiot, the sort of laughable character that we've all grown up to imagine what Ahasuerus was like. In fact, I gave up on that about a long time ago, but interestingly, about 10 or 11 years ago, I visited the British Museum. And in the British Museum, they have a wall hanging of Xerxes and Esther. Very interesting there. And you can see that this is a real Persian king. You know, this is not a gentleman who is a caricature. This is the real deal. I can't get a picture of it here. I'm sure that they have a web page, the British Museum. It'd be interesting to see that particular image. But it's very, very big. It's one of their big rooms over there. Now, if you see Xerxes here being Ahasuerus and putting the two together and realizing this is the guy, then the whole history of that 65 years that we've mentioned becomes fascinating. What happens during that 65 years is essentially you've got the rise of Xerxes in 486. Now again, remember, the 65-year period is from 538 to 473. So 486 being the rise of Ahasuerus in the middle of all of that is very fascinating. You got Ahasuerus coming along in 486, and that again is a date which I guess Rav Lau says is pretty much agreed to by a lot of people. And what happens in the Megillah? Sorry?
My son found the picture you were talking about.
Oh, it's from the British Museum. There it is. There it is. Kol HaKavod. That's what you. That's. This is the 21st century. I now introduce my courses with two things. Number one is my email address, because I said, don't call me, just send email. And number two is Sfaria.org. Sfaria.org is a phenomenon. Sfaria is a collection, it's going on at the moment, of sources which are being translated into English of everything. Everything you can possibly imagine on Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, Midrash, liturgy, the whole works. And I say to the girls, I wouldn't have done this 10 years ago, but I feel, you know, rather than beat them, join them, you know, sort of use the resource. When you're doing a research paper, this is where you go. You're going to find all your sources there. Ideally in Hebrew and also many of them in English. So having this stuff coming out like that is beautiful. So listen to this, and this is where I think the whole thing becomes so fascinating. This is a wow. You've got this 65-year period. And during the 65-year period, we've got who coming to power. If you look at the second page I gave you, in 486, Xerxes, Ahasuerus. Now, I'm trying to match up Ahasuerus of Wikipedia with Ahasuerus on the Megillah. And what I'm going to do is like this. I'm going to look at Vayhi Bimei Ahasuerus of the Megillah. And I don't want to give out the Megillahs because you know these words, but I want to read it to you. It says that he was the king for 3 years. That's what it says. And in the third year of his kingdom, he made a party. Right, Bishnat Shalosh Lamalko, the first part of the thing, Asav Mishter Lechol Sarav Avadot. So what are we talking about in years? Not 486, but 483. Okay, so we're working our way through this period till the end of the 65 years, which is in fact the year 473. So we've got 10 years before the year 473, which in tradition, as I said, is the Aliyah of Ezra to Eretz Israel. So in the background of Megillat Esther, there is, can you imagine the JNF, and you've got the Nefesh B'Nefesh, you've got all those people still working, presumably, trying to get the majority of the Jews to realize the homeland is not Persia, and the homeland is not Gold is Green, or whatever name you want to bring up. The homeland is still Eretz Israel. It's fascinating. And what's going on, back to this timeline, in 483, there are two events which take place, two parties. Now, we'll do the history first, and then we'll go back to the parties, and I'll explain, answer the question that we asked at the beginning. Just look at the bottom here, and it's all documented in the piece that I've printed out here from Wikipedia. 482, the Battle of Thermopylae. Now, any of you saw the film 300, a horribly gory movie, but but a bit of history there, that what happened was that the Persians tried to obviously expand the empire towards Greece. I mean, it was Greece and Persia. And read, what is it, Herodotus, I mean, I'm glad Ephesus, Herodotus and Plutarch, and you name all these guys that have written about this. You know, you can spend your whole life, I suppose some people do spend their whole lives reading this stuff. That's the reality. It's interesting. You know, obviously with the purpose of learning what one has to learn, at least trying to learn what one has to learn. I'm so glad you're here. This is great. So I'm not making this up, right? This is for real. The reality of this is that you've got from 486 to 483, the 3 years of Ahasuerus, and presumably part of his 3 years would be focusing on this expansion of the empire. So you get to 480, again, I'm going to go back to 483 in a minute. Look at 482, Thermopylae, the 300, the fact that Leonidas, the whole story where the 300 Spartans held off the whole Persian Empire in a small area because they stopped them moving through onto the Greek peninsula. I'm not sure exactly the names and the places, but I think it's all written here on the page. And in the end, they were all killed, the Spartans, but it was a bit of a, as you say in Yiddish, pachimponim for the Persians, who thought they were invincible, including Ahasuerus, Xerxes, who essentially considered himself as a god. And what happened, that's, by the way, in the movie, that's the most significant moment, I think, in the movie, when he is injured by a spear, if you saw that movie, and there's blood. And all of a sudden, the god is human. You know, there's like a look on his face, as if to say, I'm a god, and here I am, bleeding like everybody else. Very interesting moment in the movie. But not recommending the film, it'll keep you awake, and it's pretty gory. But the reality of it is that 482... Thermopylae was one of the original battles of the Persians to try and move into the Greek world and try and take over Greece. You've got, essentially, without going into all of the history about what happened, you'll see here that there's a whole development, but it didn't go well for the Persians. It's not a great history for them. By the year 480, you've got Battle of Salamis and then Plataea, and in both of those battles, mainly sea battles, the Persians lose. They basically had terrible defeats. So in 479, you've got essentially the Persian army returning, according to what this article says, 43,000 soldiers out of hundreds of thousands returned to Persia, Shushan, the capital, one assumes. And 479, why is that significant? Because I look at chapter 2 of Megillat Esther, and I read in verse 9, again, I don't want to sort of overdo this, but it says, is it verse 9 or verse 12? It was in the seventh year of the reign of Ahasuerus. Very interesting. The story of Esther coming to the palace, etc., etc., happened in the seventh year. Right? I can't, whenever I want to put my finger on something like that, I can't. But if you look at it in chapter 2, it will say there, the seventh year. If you look at this timeline, it now becomes very significant. I've got the years 486 when Ahasuerus begins his reign. I've got the year 479, which is chapter 2 of Megillah. So between 486 and 479, I've essentially got chapter 1 of the Megillah. When is chapter 1? It tells me the third year of the reign of Ahasuerus, in the year 483. Now think about it. If he's going on a massive campaign to conquer the Greek world, then he's got to raise an army. He's got to raise a massive army, and we take this for granted. 127 countries, and we make wonderful droshes, you know, like Sarah was 127 years, and he's 127 countries, and all these droshes. But think about the reality, what we're saying. He was the king of 127 countries. That is pretty significant. And he's got to raise an army, and he's got to convince the people from all the different countries that it's worth following Ahasuerus. Can't do it by force, by conscription. It's too big. You know, you can't conscript from all that distance away. So what has Ahasuerus got to do? He's got to bring them in to Persia. He's got to bring them into Shushan. I'll read the Psukim again. Chapter 1 of Megillat Esther. Vayhi bishnat shalosh l'molko, asam mishter. He makes a, let's not call it a party, let's call it a diplomatic, what does the queen hold? What sort of reception does she call it? A garden party, right, that's it, you know, with top hats and the whole thing. You know, where they have little...
The queen does?
I'm looking at my wife. My father-in-law went to one of these things. Your mother went to that, right? Yeah, your mother went to that. It's little sandwiches, you know, without the crust, of course, and tea with very fine tea. It's an unbelievable performance, and it's a big honor to go. I don't know. It's one of those mishigasim of the British. The diplomatic reception. Do you actually eat and go there for the purposes of eating? No. You present your credentials, or you get a yashikach or mazel tov or whatever the equivalent is from the Queen, and that's it. But look what's going on. I'll read this now. Mishnat Shalot Lemalchov, back to the Megillah. Asar Mishnei Lechosarav. This is 483, right? 3 years after he becomes king. And it says, who's coming to the party? Chel Parasa Madai, the soldiers, meaning presumably the representatives, Paratamim, Sarem Medina, all of the princes of all the different countries. And what is he doing at the party? Not stressing the food, Baratoit, Oshe, Kavod Malchotoi, showing them all of the glory of his wealth. Remember, this is the ancient world. You press people with a big harem and with lots of money and all this sort of stuff. Matzah Shmoni, 180 days. That's a serious amount of time for everybody in the 127 countries to get to Shushan. And at the end, obviously, he raises his army, because what does he do next? Bimlot Yomim Ha'Ela, the end of the 180, Asar Melech Chalam and Imsa Mishushani, let his hair down with his local people. Let's make a like they say in England, a street party. Right, when the Queen has an event, they always get people out in the streets with tables. You see pictures of this after coronations or whatever, and the whole nation rejoices. And this is what was happening in Shushan. After you've got the commitment of the 127 leaders of the ancient world to go with him to this war, then he makes a second party, a celebration for the local people who presumably had to host all these guys and had to put up with all the interruption and everything else and all the traffic jams and who knows what. And that is the second party. And at that party already you'd get all the different discussions about how much drink and all the rest of it. It's unbelievable. And when you just put a little bit of historical perspective into this, all of a sudden what has come out of it is that the two parties become much clearer. The purpose, they're two different purposes to these gatherings, celebration. One to create an army to conquer the world, and the second one to celebrate, one assumes, the fact that that army was created. Unbelievable. And with this historical analysis put into the text of the Megillah, the whole story takes on a whole new meaning. Now, if we're going to go further than this, I fear that the next revelation is even more shocking, because this is where it gets really unbelievable. Because the conclusion of what was saying, and this is about as much as I'm going to say, because more than this and I'm going to get struck down by lightning in a minute, I'm really scared. Our image of Mordechai and Esther. We grew up with, again, you know, back to the kids' world of dressing up. Esther Malkah, you know, my granddaughter's not here because she wouldn't be happy what I'm going to say. Esther Malkah, you know, this wonderful image of the tzaddikus Esther and Mordechai, the rabbi with the very long beard, you know, and all the rest of it. And we have this, and again, the rabbis fed into this, right? The rabbis did not shy away from any of this. The reality of it is, says Rav Lau, this is the rabbinic approach, but he says if you take the historic approach, it's got a different connotation. And the different connotation is really quite shocking. Because what are we talking about with Jewish society? The rabbis definitely agree on one thing, that the Jews attended the second party. And they say part of the reason why the destruction was going to come about of the Jewish community was that previously, this is 9 years later that the whole story of Haman takes place, 9 years after the party took place, so we're in the year 483, so we've got 9 years later, 474, right, when the whole Purim story takes place. The reality of it is that situation of what was going on, the Jewish community was, let's put it very bluntly, very assimilated. There's no reason to assume otherwise. In fact, on the page, the first page that I gave you, Rav Lau quotes from Sefer Yecheskel, which is the quotations in the middle of the page, where he shows you that there were different groups of Jews in Bavel at the time, some who were more committed to Eretz Yisrael, some who wanted to, you know, the sort of the more right wing, what I would call the ones, you know, living in their own sort of gated communities somewhere in the north part of New York. There are, to make a comparison, there are other groups who were even more extreme than that, and will always be, you know, pro-Israel, but again, a small group, but stayed in the Gola. He says Daniel represents the sort of success of the Jews in the Gola. He was one of the faithful ones to God, but clearly had achieved tremendous success. What Rav Lau wants to suggest, and this again is just sort of, to me, it was just beyond belief, that in terms of Mordechai and Esther, we're talking about assimilated Jews. We're talking about two people at the beginning of the story. When Mordechai is sitting in the gate of the king, is he there because he's a Jew who's respected by the community, that he's allowed to sit in that place, which is a very honorable place? Or is he so high up in the hierarchy of Persia that, for want of a better thing, you know, he's like someone who's in the hierarchy of, in the cabinet of the prime minister, of the president, who sits in a high place in Washington, in London, wherever it may be? And Rav Lau's suggestion, which is really outrageous, but maybe very on the mark, is that maybe Mordechai at the beginning was an assimilated person. And Esther, and this is the real kicker, was in fact not necessarily dragged to the palace at the beginning, but was looking at this as an opportunity to move up the scale. If she could get in there, and if she could then marry or be one of the king's, you know, consorts, or whatever you want to call them, then that was a step up in, you know, getting closer to power, getting closer to influence, changes the image of Esther and changes the image of Mordechai drastically. The beauty of his commentary will be the I'm going to use the word, metamorphosis of Mordechai and Esther. Because by chapter 4, they begin to realize that as secular Jewish as they are, they're in places where they can actually do something about the impending disaster to the Jewish community. And then all of a sudden their whole, how should we say, their Jewishness becomes much more serious. And by the time you get to the end of the book, Mordechai is the recognized leader of the Jewish people. I always tell rabbis, L'rov, it says, L'rov Echad. Not to everybody. Not everybody liked Mordechai. He saved their tuchuses, as you say, and still there's a minority who come along and say, he's not for us. That's Jews. You're very hard to please everybody. The reality, that's the story. That's what it says. But it doesn't matter. The reality of it is that by the end, and I can understand why people were still reluctant, because look at his history. I'll blow your minds with the Midrash, because the Midrash puts it, it's unreal. And I haven't got the text for you, but it's something you can look up. Midrash says that Mordechai was a captain in the Persian army. So how he remained Yeshiva Boch and a captain in the Persian army has never been clear to me. But he was a captain in the Persian army, and very high up. And who was equally high up at that time? Haman. He actually had a relationship with him. And Ahasuerus at the time had sent out money for the raising of troops and whatever, and funds for food and whatever they had to, weapons, I don't know what they needed for. And Haman had blown it, the equivalent of, you know, he went to Las Vegas or wherever and he just blew the money. It doesn't say how he got rid of it, but he didn't have any money to use for that purpose. So he goes to Mordechai, you know, lend me some money, Mordechai. I need some money to do what the king has asked me to do. Mordechai says, Bakasha, here it is, but here's an IOU. And the IOU is that you'll always be subservient to me. All right? Interesting. So of course, what happens in chapter 3 of the story of Megillat Esther, along comes Haman, the big knacker, and he says to everybody, you've got to bow down. So what does Mordechai say? I'm not going to bow down to him, he's my servant. I should bow down to him, he should bow down to me. And all of a sudden, the whole story takes on a whole different view, a whole different image. And again, are we allowed to sort of expand Mordechai and Esther into those realms, away from what I would call traditional rabbinic view? If you're prepared to take on board a more historic perspective, and this is what Rav Lau does, not to denigrate, God forbid, not to push away the rabbinic response, the rabbinic tradition, but to say there are different ways of looking at the story, which is what history is about. When you study history, you know, the person writing about it will essentially give his or her interpretation of what the events are about. And it can come out, the same event can be seen from two different perspectives, two different situations. And that is Megillat Esther. And what I've done, I hope, in the course of this presentation, is really to say, to present to you and to give you a challenge to sort of, you know, get real about Megillat Esther. Megillat Esther is one of those stories which, I don't know about you, but I'm not totally comfortable about. It's one of those things that with the holiday is fine, but when you're at work, you know, you say you're not going to come in because it's Purim. And they say, what's Purim? And then you have to go, you know, you sort of say, well, it's a nice Jewish holiday. You don't explain the fact that the Jews stood up and killed 75,000 non-Jews. Not a good line to say to your boss about Purim if your boss is not Jewish. Even if he is Jewish, you won't really like it very much. And it's not, it's one of those difficult holidays to really get real about. But we need to get more real about it, because I think once we do, we get so much more out of it. Look how the history, whether you want to argue the history and you want to argue the dates, and I'm just presenting, the way that Rav Lau presents it, but I'm sure there can be different dates put on this. But the reality of it is that when you see the story of Purim revolving not just around the community in Babylon or now in Persia, what it represented, but the fact that they were disconnected from Eretz Yisrael. So Eretz Yisrael is really such a major part of the Purim story, but not frontline, but certainly the bigger picture of Purim. And you understand that we're talking about a assimilated community which rediscovers its Jewishness and becomes more connected and devoted. And of course, you get to the year, back to that timeline, 473, with the Aliyah of Ezra, followed by Nehemiah later on, and then finally the temple is built, and the walls of Jerusalem are established, and the community is beginning to develop itself in Eretz Israel, the second temple period. All of a sudden, the story of Purim becomes so much more connected to this bigger tapestry of history that we understand. The always linking things to Eretz Israel, and Purim is so much part of that, as much as Hanukkah is, and as much essentially as the 40 years in the desert, and everything else that we learn in Jewish history, all revolving around Eretz Israel. And I just want to sort of finish with this thought, because it's from the Parsha yesterday, and it's just, it's something which sort of, you know, I heard this, and I couldn't sort of get my mind off it. The Jews were in the desert, and when they were in the desert, they had a command to build a Mishkan. So what did they use? They used acacia wood, Asei Shittim. Now, again, if you've had that experience of flying over the Negev, which I did once, I don't want to repeat it, sort of in a tiny plane at the time. It was horrible. But it was a beautiful view. I have to say that about it. Where do you find trees in the desert? Where do you find trees in the Sinai desert? Acacia wood. So Rashi asks the question. And Rashi says that Yaakov Avinu knew in prophetic vision that the Jews were going to go into slavery in Egypt. And he went to Be'er Sheva, and he took the trees that Avram Avinu had planted in Be'er Sheva, and he took them with down to Eretz Mitzrayim when he went down to Egypt, and they planted them in Egypt. And that's where the wood came from. It was always there. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in his commentary explains, and he says something fabulous. He says that in the Golah, in the exile, when the deepest darkness of the Egyptian exile, the Jews were looking for chizuk, they were looking for strength. And one of the things that gave them tremendous strength was to see those trees, that line of trees, because the line of trees said to them, this is the link to Yaakov, to Avram Avinu, to Eretz Israel. If we are ever going to get out of this, please God, not if, we, those trees are going to come with us. And they are going to build the Mishkan, which are going to be taking us through the desert. They thought, not very long, the Mishkan was going to be built in Eretz Israel, as far as they were concerned. And that was all going to be a reminder, a connection to Eretz Israel. And if that connection to Eretz Israel is there, then that is the hope, that is the siman tov. And I'm going to make my wife laugh. I always argue the sign of a good Yekesha home, right? You walk into a house, you know where people come from, their origins. So how do you know they come from Yekes? And I'm going to pull her leg because she'll kill me for this. One of the signs of good upbringing is that they have on the eastern side of the house the sign Mizrach. Right, you don't see this in many other homes. You don't see, maybe you do, but I never saw it. But Yekis, this was the tradition from Germany, that even though you're standing in wherever, my father-in-law from Karlsruhe, Germany, where he was born, he would have had on the Eastern wall Mizra with an image of Jerusalem. You never forget that connection. In our homes, we have stuff from Israel. We have mezuzah from Israel. We have the wall hanging, whatever. That is, it may be incidental, but it's so important. Because that means that as much as we are in Cherry Hill or in wherever, in whatever community we find ourselves around the world, but we're really on the way to Eretz Israel. We haven't lost that Kesher. And what I'm so fearful of the American Jewish community is how many have lost that kesher. They don't have the Israel wall hanging anymore, and they don't have the mezuzah from Israel. And that's a challenge for people in education, people like myself, and the new generations coming up have to recreate that by making sure that connection to Israel is there, even if it's tenuous, but it should be there. Because what one thing we learn from Megillat Esther is once they disconnect or almost disconnect, you get a homon, and God forbid, if that would have gone the wrong way, who knows where we would be today. And again, just with a little bit of historical perspective, I think this whole story takes on a whole new message, a whole new meaning, and I hope Bezrat Hashem, a whole new Purim, right? You know, maybe you'll get to Purim this time, and just look at the story with different eyes. 16 lessons available, please, if you have the time to listen to them while you're Torah. Developing these themes, there's a lot more to say, but that is, in a nutshell, is sort of a bit of an introduction, and I hope, you know, there was something to think about here. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you. Any questions before we depart?
Modern-day parallels.
Make them up as you go along. And who's someone today? Yeah. I'm not going to say it because there's too much political tension in the room if I say the word that I'm thinking of. It's a challenge. It's a big challenge. And who's the Ahasuerus? Not so bumbly. Read the history of Xerxes. This guy was not bumbly. Man. Yeah.
You really think it was a convocation, basically?
Yeah. 180 days. Otherwise, yeah. Why have a second party? What do you need the second party
for? Right. Well, he was trying to consolidate his power, obviously, and so how do you get people to buy into what you want to do?
But that distinguished part, the first part where it's all the hoi polloi, as they say, and the second part, which is the men of Shush.
Yeah, loyalists.
Yeah. But
well, he could bribe them by offering them something, obviously.
He offered them probably quite a lot.
Yeah, so
that's right. And the whole thing with Vashti is a whole side issue, but it's very important as well, because that's strength, his strength over Vashti, you know, and the Malbim talks about that in a big deal as well. Mm-hmm. So there's so much to say, but it's such a fabulous story. It becomes a whole new parsha.
But you're saying, though, that I don't know if it says this in the text, but like, you know, like a lot of commentators would say that, oh, these parties are like drunken revelry, as opposed to like, you know, the very orderly, you know, courtly parties that this might have been.
Right. And that, of course, takes on a whole new image of the story as well.
That Ahasuerus was like in his cups when he called Vashti to come over?
In his cups.
Drunk.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but that was the second party. That was his establishing his authority. He's saying that I am the boss, and I can even get Vashti. Remember, Vashti was the Yichus. She was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, so he wanted to have her under his control in public. Right? He went way too far, and you know, killing her maybe was not what he thought of, but he was drunk.
Symbol of subjugation,
and putting this all together, it's like the whole story takes on a whole new meaning. You've revisited Megillat Esther. I'll leave you to think about this because it's really something special. Bezrat Hashem, next time, something completely different. Talking a bit about evolution and science. Well, let's go for it. Torah and evolution. In 4 weeks, March 2nd, I think. I think so. Bezrat Hashem. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Yes.